to Hotel Bar Sessions, the podcast where three philosophers sit down at the end of a long conference day to chop it up at the hotel bar, which, as we all know, is where the real philosophy happens.
Welcome back to another episode of Hotel Bar Sessions. I'm Jason Reed, and as usual, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rick Lee and Lee Johnson. This week, we are talking about academic freedom, and stay tuned for a special announcement at the end of the show. But before all that, we got to get drink orders and rants and raves in. So, Rick, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
This week, I'm going to go back to one of my regulars. I'll have a rye Manhattan, please. And I am raving about Haley Tuck's cover of the Joni Mitchell song Cactus Tree. Joni Mitchell's version of Cactus Tree is an amazing song, and I really love it. But Haley Tuck adds a dimension to this that I think is really exciting. I'm a little embarrassed to rave about this, because if you imagine what kind of a contemporary jazz singer a middle-aged white cis man would like, Haley Tuck is that singer. So I'm a little embarrassed, but it really is a fantastic song. It's Cactus Tree by Haley Tuck.
So, Lee, what are you having and what are you ranting or raving about?
I'm just going to have a vodka martini today. I think I want it wet, but we had this conversation before and I forget which one has the...
Dry.
Okay. The one with less vermouth is dry. Okay. So that's the one that I want. Dirty. Very, very dirty. And I'm raving this week about Chantel Simone, otherwise known as the millennial mentor on TikTok. So the millennial mentor basically gives office advice for the most part for millennials from a millennial. And she's really great. And I really recommend that people follow her channel. But this week she gave what I feel like is the most important advice that I have never heard before. And that is how to set your Microsoft Outlook so that when you send an email, no one can reply all to it.
Woohoo!
Yes, it's a real thing. I'm going to let her explain it to you right now.
So you're going to act like you're about to send a new email, right? You're going to go over here to options under encrypt. Click on that and then click on where it says do not reply to all. Once you click on that, a little message is going to come up and it is going to confirm that recipients of your email will not have the ability to reply all. Please go ahead and try this out the next time you have to send an email to an extensive list of people. And then you and all of your colleagues should come back and thank me later for sparing your inbox.
Please, everyone, become evangelists of this tool because we need this. All right, Jason, what about you? What are you drinking and what are you ranting or raving about?
I'm going to have a dark and stormy in honor of spending a very dark and stormy night with a dog who couldn't decide if he should protect his people from the wind or be protected from the scary noises the wind made. And I am raving about old punk rockers. I've been listening to a lot of releases from people who have been around for a while. Jay Robbins has a new album, Basilisk. He was the frontman of Government Issue, Jawbox, and other bands. Alec McKay has a new band, Hammered Hulls. Bikini Killer out there touring. Mary Timony has a new band. These are all people who have been at this for a long time and never really made it big, never wanted to make it big, but kept doing it. And that is the punkest attitude to have. So celebrating that. Rick, we're talking about academic freedom. How do you want to talk about that?
Well, I'm excited to hear what this big announcement might be. But before we do that, recently, Nathan Kufnis, who holds a early career fellowship from the Leverhulme Trust, is being threatened with losing his position at Cambridge University because he's a race realist. And in particular, he stated that there is a difference in natural intelligence in people of different races. He has argued that race realism, if widely adopted, would be the end of what he calls, without defining it, wokeism. And he unsurprisingly argues that he has the right to claim all of these things and speak about all of these things because of Cambridge University's free speech policy. Now, this case raises several issues. For example, does a mathematics professor have the academic freedom and free speech right to teach that 2 plus 2 equals 7? Koufness is not himself a biologist, a physician, a physiologist, or a neuroscientist. So does he have the right to teach something that is false or, at best, way outside the consensus of scientists researching the field? Should we not consider the fact that Koufness is on the record as saying that he wants to poke the bear of wokeism, and therefore he seems more interested in raising controversy than in seeking the truth? And finally, can we just put away the notion that there are two sides to every issue?
So, Rick, I'm glad that we're actually talking about academic freedom. It's something that I know we've all been wanting to talk about for a long time. But since we're using this Koufness case as a case study, I think we have to first explain what race realism is. Race realism is a metaphysical position, really, a controversial metaphysical perspective that argues that there are inherent and significant biological differences among human races, and that those lead to variations in intellectual abilities, behaviors, social outcomes, character traits, etc. Advocates of race realism argue that these differences are rooted in genetic factors rather than influenced by environmental or cultural factors. But as you mentioned before, it is very important to note that for the most part, the scientific community widely rejects race realism. And that's due to the lack of robust empirical evidence supporting the existence of distinct and deterministic racial categories for complex human traits. So this is a controversial position, but controversial in a way that is maybe slightly different than other controversial positions that are often pointed to when talking about academic freedom. I mean, on the one hand, this is a very harmful position. Race realists will often use their perspective to argue for the superiority and inferiority of different races. I mean, Koufness himself said that if Harvard University were a meritocracy, they would have no black professors.
Oh, Jesus
That's,
Christ.
Yeah. So there's that. But also, this is a philosopher challenging the consensus of the scientific community that race is not a valid biological concept, nor is it causally linked to things like cognitive, moral, or social capacities.
Let me just point out for Dave that when Lee talks about a metaphysical position, what she's talking about is a position about what is real or what the being of the thing in question is. And so the race realist says that race is a real thing out there in the world, like a table or a chair.
And it's always tables and chairs.
It's always, yeah.
They're the realest things.
They're the realest things.
They're the realest things I can think of.
Like, it's always a table and a chair when you're talking about what is metaphysically real, just like it's always a toaster when you're trying to compare AI to something else.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what a metaphysical position is. And I've said this before, when I'm trying to think about what a position is trying to say, I often think of as opposed to what. And so when I think about race realism as opposed to what, I think it's the position widely held by the scientific community and by the academic community, namely that differences that can be measured empirically among races, like differences in IQ and income levels and so on, are the result of what we could generally call culture and sociocultural impacts on the lives of individuals, and not because of some inherent quality that belongs to them because of a race that they have.
Yeah, I mean, just to give it a name, the as opposed to what position would be constructivism, which is to say that race is a socially constructed category. There was an anthropologist, Ashley Montague, who described race as a omelet, right? He said, like, basically what anthropologists did was that they took a lot of different characteristics and they put them together and they made this thing called race. But the category race is not found in genetics. It's not found in biology. It's not as if, you know, if you did a 23andMe test, they're going to find your black gene or your Asian gene, which is, you know, of course, ridiculous because Asia is a continent. It's not, it's not a gene.
One of the things I want to bring up is that, as you guys are saying, that race is to some extent a antiquated, multiply times disproven notion But there's a way in which it keeps coming back, unlike other antiquated notions from the same periods. And I just want to read a brief quote from Stuart Hall's famous essay and lecture. You can even watch the lecture online, Race the Floating Signifier. Mm-hmm. He says, "As we know, human genetic variability between different populations, normally assigned a racial category, is not significantly greater than it is within those populations." I think that's a pretty succinct statement about why race doesn't make sense. But then he says, "Second, this fact has never prevented intense scholarly activity being devoted by a minority of committed academics to attempting to prove a correlation between racially defined genetic characteristics and cultural performance." In other words, we are not dealing with a field in which, as it were, the scientifically and rationally established fact prevents scientists from continuing to prove the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from 1997. And the one thing I think about hearing this today is, on the one hand, we're not hearing people try to bring back the theory of spontaneous generation, right? That if you leave meat out for a while, maggots will suddenly emerge from it. So in that sense, Hall is right. But now we see a lot of previously discredited positions trying to eke their way back into the academy, creationism being a big one, and its various forms of intelligent design and so on, which leads me to my second point, and that is, I would say that part of the reason race keeps coming back, despite being disproven, has nothing to do with it not being dealt with within the field of knowledge adequately, but because race plays such a huge role in political ideologies that it keeps trying to work its way back in the academy. And Kaufness makes it pretty clear that he sees himself as trying to help the right not be stupid. He thinks if they accept what he calls wokeism, which is really, as far as I can understand, it's all men are created equal.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he's calling wokeism. If you accept that, then you end up having to delegitimate racial hierarchies, and he wants to put racial hierarchies back on scientific grounds. And so part of what's happening around race is the political demands are driving the intellectual demands.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's key here, because Kaufness wants to have it both ways. He wants to have it, as you said, that we need to eliminate wokeism in order to get racial hierarchies back in place and to give them some kind of legitimacy. But he also wants to insist on racial hierarchies in order to get rid of wokeism. And by the way, he sometimes calls wokeism equalism. I think it's a way of him avoiding saying egalitarianism, because that sounds like a good thing. And equalism, I don't know, it doesn't. But I think this points to one main fact, namely that when a mathematician is investigating, I don't know, Fermat's last theorem or something like that, there's not a lot of political and cultural and social positions and theory that gets in the way of thinking about whether 2 + 2 = 4 or 7. But here, it seems as if it's impossible to get out from behind those filters that are propelling an interest in this being a science to get to actual empirical facts.
Yeah, and at the risk of maybe throwing in too many unnecessary new vocabulary terms here, I do want to say that there is, of course, a position that can acknowledge that race is real and not biologically real.
Right.
You can acknowledge that race is socially and politically real.
Yeah.
And not genetically based. And that's really important, because another argument within the study of race is the argument that's called racial eliminativism. Mm. So the idea that if race is not biologically real, let's just stop talking about it, right? Like it's like Santa Claus, you know, let's just get rid of it. And then we can all see that everybody's equal. Obviously, there are many problems with that, because we are on the tail end of several hundred years of people believing that race was real and treating it as if it was biologically real. There are effects of that treatment. There are social and political and economic effects of that. And if we just get rid of the category tomorrow and say, like, look, nobody else can say the word race or refer to racial categories, then we are literally unable to survey our world as it actually is and survey the injustices and differences in our world as they actually are. So I want to be very clear because I know that a lot of people, when you say race realism is a largely disproven theory, will say, so you're just saying race is not real. I can see the differences, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, it is real. It's just not genetic.
Right. And so it's the difference between the reality of a structure and the reality of a table or a chair.
I knew we were coming back to that.
Or a toaster.
I think your point supports but also expands on the point Jason was making earlier, because what Kofnas is explicitly worried about, and I think we're going to have to put some links to his work in the show notes, but
yeah.
I so hesitate to do this because I don't want to give this any air. But anyhow, he is explicit about saying, if I hold the position that race is socially and politically real in the way you were talking about, Lee, then what follows from that is I have to socially and politically work against the effects of race, which is precisely, and this was Jason's point, what for Kofnas is wokeism.
Mm-hmm. What is this equalist nonsense that you're spewing?
I know I have this stupid idea that all people are equal.
It's worth pointing out, Lee said, this is a different position than race limitativism, as you said.
Yeah.
Which I often equate with the common move you see in conservative thinking where they want to reduce Martin Luther King Jr.'s entire legacy to people should be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their
exactly.
skin.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
To some extent, I feel like that was the prevailing conservative opinion about race for a long mm-hmm. time. And yeah. I do think it's worth asking the question, what is this turn towards realism? And Kofnas is clear about this. He thinks it's a stronger position. The idea that race doesn't exist means you shouldn't see the effects of race socially. Colorblind perpetuation of racism is not sufficient anymore. And it's worth pointing out because, you know, so many thinkers around race, you know, Charles Mills made the distinction between de jure and de facto racism, pointed to race becoming an unstated premise of social relations, that race functions by not acknowledging it. As you were saying, Lee, hundreds of years of race being a structure thing in society, by just sort of not acknowledging it, it can kind of keep going on because its inequalities are so entrenched. Mm-hmm. And now there seems to be this real push to say that isn't sufficient. We want to go mm-hmm. beyond that and we want to re-entrench them. Like to go back to the Harvard example, usually you could count on the fact that inequalities and access to education would keep Harvard white enough just on their own. But now that's not enough. And something that seems like it's from the past has to be reasserted in the present.
And I want to just take a minute to acknowledge the irony of the fact that what race realists purport to be doing is to explain the world as it is with reference to genetics, right? Mm-hmm. With reference to biology, and overlook the fact that you could make the same explanation. You could say that race is real, not biologically real, not genetically real, but you could say that race is socially constructed, politically, socially real. And that is what we need to understand, that race forms the deep metaphysical struts and girders. That's a phrase from Charles Mills, the deep metaphysical struts and girders of our social world. And so we can't just do away with it. We absolutely cannot. That would be to misunderstand our world. But we can explain it by reference to something that is also a misunderstanding of what race is.
And just before we leave the subject of race realism, we also need to separate this position that Kofnas has from the position that a researcher would have who's looking at, for example, Gower's disease, which has a prevalence among Ashkenazi Jews, or sickle cell disease, including sickle cell anemia, which is prevalent among Africans and some Middle Eastern groups. That's not the same as this biological realism of race. For example, in my family, there's a genetic disposition to high cholesterol. That's the gift I've received. And it's the gift that keeps on giving. This kind of racial science that Kofnas is promoting and insisting on its validity has a long history within colonial structures, within the Atlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. That is, it has a history of grounding the oppression of people based on race.
As a metaphysical kind.
Exactly. And make it seem as if that's natural because it's just the way reality is.
Exactly. Yeah. So the difficult thing about using this as a case study about academic freedom, I think, is that what motivated much of the research that disproved race realism was the wide acceptance of race realism, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this had a kind of renaissance in the early 90s when The Bell Curve was published, which re-forwarded this race realist argument that there are broadly intellectual differences between the races. And it was because of the bell curve that so much of the philosophical research about anti-race realism or racial constructivism was accomplished. So there is a way in which I want to say, yeah, of course he has the academic freedom to say this, and all the people that attempt to disprove him are doing good research, partially because he's putting this view out here, not Kaufness, but Derrick Bell, and, you know, going back hundreds of years, many, many before them. Now we're back to the question of if this is largely disproven. I mean, disproven is maybe too strong of a word, but largely not accepted by the peer-reviewed scientific community and the peer-reviewed philosophical community. Mm-hmm. Can he still say it? Now we're back to the academic freedom question.
Did you know that Hotel Bard Podcast is more than just a podcast? We are a fully online, cross-brand synergy platform of content creation. Actually, that's not true. Those words are meaningless. But you can follow us on the app formerly known as Twitter at Hotel Bard Podcast. There you can find the handles of all the co-hosts as well. You can follow us all or pick your favorite. If by the time you hear this, Elon Musk has burned down the servers to collect the insurance, you can also find us on Facebook or YouTube. Just look for Hotel Bard Sessions. Wherever you find us on social media, you can contact us with ideas, complaints, and questions. You can also email us anytime at hotelbarpodcast@gmail.com or visit our interactive page at hotelbarpodcast.com. No matter how you get in contact with us, we're always glad to hear from you.
Here's where the difficulty comes in, because if I go back to my mathematics example, I don't know that I would argue that a mathematician teaching that 2 plus 2 equals 7 is covered by academic freedom. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that I want to die on that hill, but it seems to me somehow not an abridgment of academic freedom to say that a mathematician can't teach 2 plus 2 equals 7.
Okay, so here's where I'm going to probably regret saying this. If it's in the pursuit of knowledge, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, so I can't imagine what theory somebody would be working on to want to forward that 2 plus 2 equals 7. I can't imagine, right? Like, you know, that numbers are entirely made up and they're not real kinds and et cetera. But it does seem to me that that is not objectionable as a basis for inquiry. It's not objectionable as a basis for research.
Okay, but then what about, let's say, a Latin teacher telling me that, I don't know, the second person singular present indicative of a verb is this, when it turns out that it has a completely different form than that teacher is teaching. So rather than saying amas, the teacher says, no, it's amigabibas. I mean, that seems just not true.
Well, what I would say is that if your Latin teacher is teaching that to you as a student in your class, I think that there are problems with that. I mean, there are obvious problems with that. And there are avenues within universities to correct that. But that's a different thing than saying you want to research and publish a paper claiming that. Mm. I think that you wouldn't get that paper published, period. Mm-hmm. Kaufness is publishing a paper based on stuff that has been published, stuff that really is still out there as live questions.
But I think it's also worth pointing out that, as far as I could tell, most of Koffness's research is either published on his blog or in journals that have been devoted to exactly this kind of crackpot research.
Except the actual article that we're talking about, which was published in, you know, a relatively prominent philosophical journal. Philosophical Psychology, that's the journal. I mean, and the editors published an extensive defense of their decision to publish this article.
The other thing about the Koffness example that doesn't quite get captured by the 2 plus 2 equals 7 is the fact that, as we said at the beginning of the show, he is engaging with questions that belong under the disciplines of, you know, anthropology, neurology, and so on. And there's a certain sense in which you could argue that we best settled by the scholars in those fields. And as we sort of mentioned, the scholars in those fields predominantly argue that race doesn't make sense as a biological concept. But the other issue, which I think is worth talking about here, is that a division of labor and specialization way of dealing with academic freedom doesn't really get at the core issue that to have a philosophical discussion about race is to engage with metaphysics, as you guys have said, questions of anthropology, questions of politics, questions of history. Like, it's not a problem that belongs to any one discipline, like all problems that we discuss. And we all find ourselves, I mean, in the classroom, I find myself constantly referring to things from history. I mean, I admit my reading in the arguments against the concept of race is not as deep as it could be because that's not my specialization.
So you accept, you know, the consensus view. And I think that that's how most academics work when they're working interdisciplinarily.
Right.
Interdisciplinarily.
But I do think that part of the issue is that we are constantly crossing the boundaries of our discipline in doing our discipline.
Yeah.
But I wonder, is there a difference between, I don't know quite how to put this, the way I'm thinking of it, and maybe this will have to be sharpened, isn't there a difference between publishing, for example, my research and editorializing?
Mm-hmm.
I know that in philosophy in particular, this might not be so easily distinguished, but I think in other fields, it probably is fairly easily distinguished. Like the difference between a number theorist publishing an article on a particular aspect of number theory is one thing. But that same number theorist publishing something on what kinds of research should be done within mathematics is a different piece. It's more of an editorial piece talking about the nature of the discipline and so on, and less about specific research and, you know, pointing to evidence and proofs and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that an awful lot of the work we're talking about in relation to Koffness, I would say, is much more editorializing than philosophical work. He doesn't have really arguments about a position. He has arguments about this kind of thing should be allowed.
Well, actually, devil's advocate. Well, actually, I do think one could argue all academic research is editorial in one way or another. Although I agree with you, I'm not sure that that all by itself is dispositive. You know, I mean, how are we going to advance knowledge if we don't permit these investigations?
But do we want to permit investigations into, like, the ether or phlogiston or other?
Yes, so that they can be disproven, so that we can advance knowledge. So do I want a prize-winning Cambridge scholar to be forwarding those arguments? Absolutely not.
Right.
Right. You know, and I think that his colleagues ought to be wary of him, you know, and I think that he probably, sorry, I don't know you, Koffness, you probably shouldn't be an award-winning Cambridge philosopher if this is the stuff that you're doing. But on principle, I do believe in academic freedom, and I do think that this is exactly what it's there for. This is exactly why it's a principle in higher education, is because we have to permit unpopular ideas. I'm very carefully choosing that word and not controversial ideas,
right,
because I don't want to get on the side of Jordan Peterson, but I think that that's true.
No, and I agree with you, and it's worth pointing out that the protection of unpopular positions defends and protects as much the critique of race realism as it does the propounding of race realism as a position.
Right.
The definition of academic freedom from the American Association of University Professors states as follows: the freedom of a teacher or researcher in higher education to investigate and discuss the issues in his or her academic field and a teacher publish findings without interference from political figures, board of trustees, donors, or other entities. Academic freedom also protects the right of faculty members to speak freely when participating in institutional governance, as well as speak freely as a citizen. Now, what I find significant about that definition in terms of what we're discussing is that all the people it mentions are kind of outsiders, donors, boards of trustees, etc. Mm-hmm. Partly mm-hmm. what we're talking about is, should you be able to work in a field if everyone in that field says this is bunk? Right. This makes no sense, because we're talking about the ability of the fields to create their own standard and consensus. One, critics of the academy and people who use words like wokeism would argue that that standard is an entirely a political standard. Like, you know, yeah. we're all lefties and we're all deciding based on our politics. That's tricky, because when it comes to knowledge, especially knowledge about the human world, a knowledge that is not reducible to tables and chairs, you know, we're the only standard we have, right? It's us. Right. Figuring stuff out is all we have to go by. It's always going to remain a little bit uncertain. Is that consensus a product of people saying, we figured this out, we've all come to the agreement, or is that consensus the product of, we're all on this team, and if you're not on our team, we're not interested in you?
Right.
And right. I would point out that that itself, determining when stuff is political and when stuff is actual knowledge, well, that's a philosophical question that we can only just constantly keep debating over.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's important not to take the consensus of the expert community as the truth. I mean, that's why we have academic freedom. That's how we make progress in things. I'll just use an example that, you know, is sort of a part of my life right now. There's a tremendous amount of debate in philosophy of technology about whether or not to consider AI as minds or even persons, right? And this is a, for the most part, consensus of experts that goes back more than 2,000 years that separates Fuses from Techne, right? Natural things from made things, and says, look, technologies are different metaphysical kinds than human beings are. And I think that we have good reason to question that. I think there's very good reason for people to say the consensus of the expert community here might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There is another consensus going back more than 2,000 years, namely that knowledge is only of what is true. That is, I can't say that I know something that is false. If we accept that, then it seems like in the pursuit of knowledge, one relevant feature would have to be whether the thing I'm claiming or pursuing is true or not. But I think what each of you are pointing out in different ways, and there are lots of reasons, but that is something that we don't necessarily always have the ability to adjudicate. This is what moves the pragmatist tradition to say something like, well, that truth is worked out not by the individual, but by the community of inquiry. And one of the things I wonder is, in this definition of academic freedom, do we put too much emphasis on the individual and not enough on the community of inquiry?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to open up a Pandora's box here, but I just want to mention it. We don't have to go all the way down the road of this, but we do have to acknowledge that the community of inquiry has tremendous structural problems.
Exactly.
Right
yes.
now. It used to be the case that we could have more confidence in, for example, peer-reviewed published research. Now it is just a fact that the system of peer review is deeply, deeply, deeply flawed. Part of that is because experts are overworked. They don't have time to do peer reviews. And so what gets published is often not actually reviewed by experts
yeah.
or is reviewed by people who don't have the time to give it the attention that it needs. Or, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Right. There are many, many problems. But it's still the only system that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm less inclined to say now that the community of experts is as trustworthy as it used to be, But I think that we have to maintain the principle of academic freedom in order to forward knowledge, period.
I agree. But while I insist on that, it's still open to question, to whom does academic freedom apply?
Academics. That's the other thing. Like, if this guy was publishing this on his blog, then it falls under the principle of free speech. Doesn't fall under the principle of academic freedom. It's like if I, in my classroom, was promoting some point of view that is my personal point of view that has nothing to do with philosophy, I think that there are good reasons to fire me for that. And that would not violate my academic freedom. I mean, academic freedom is a freedom for the pursuit of knowledge or the pursuit of truth or the pursuit of the advancement of your field. If I'm just spewing conspiracy theories in my classroom and claiming academic freedom, that's not academic freedom. That's free speech.
Right.
But free speech is not something that applies in the same way in my classroom as it does in the public square.
I definitely agree that some of the cases you hear about, like a biology professor going on and on about how terrible Trump is, that's not academic freedom. That's editorializing on students' time. Although I will point out, and I always love this example, my father took a statistics class during the Vietnam War, and the professor was very opposed to the Vietnam War, didn't editorialize about it, but all of his examples in class were about, like, the U.S. dropped so many bombs, and those bombs killed this many people in a village. And he figured out a way to make his point while still teaching statistical distributions and so on. It was just about, like, napalm rather than something else.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, if you're still teaching your subject matter and you can work in whatever else, I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem with people using a classroom to editorialize on things outside of the field or class they're supposedly teaching.
Well, I agree with you. I think that, you know, if there's a statistics professor, and there have been, who refuse to, for example, use gender-neutral pronouns,
right,
I don't think that they have the academic freedom to do that. And I think that depending on what the policies of the university are, I think there are probably good reasons to fire somebody for that. But that's not advancing research. That's not academic freedom.
Right.
But the difficulty in all of this and why there's room for debate is that it's not always clear what is advancing knowledge and what is, as Jason put it, and I put it earlier, editorializing. So the statistics professor is maybe a relatively easy example, like the statistics professor refusing to use the appropriate pronouns for one of their students. That has nothing to do with statistics. But for example, a biology professor teaching the biological basis of racial differences in intelligence, that seems not to be editorializing, but it seems also to be a position that stands outside of the consensus of the community of inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And that I would defend. I wouldn't like it, but I would defend it. And I'm woke.
I think one of the things that we have to include in this discussion, and I take Lee's point about the standards of peer review are falling apart. They're not falling apart because of wokeism. They're falling apart because of
capitalism.
Everything is falling apart because of capitalism, because overwork and failure to fund and so on. But I will say this. We've been using this word consensus, and I think it's worth pointing out that in a lot of fields, there's not that much of a consensus. I mean, we come from philosophy and, you know, we've done shows about deconstruction and Derrida, and some philosophers, some philosophy departments would claim that he was an important contribution to 20th century thought, and others would claim he was an absolute charlatan. And you could say the same about John Rawls or something. Maybe that's not the best example. But, you know, you could say the same about someone on the other side who'd be respected and considered to be not worthy. The reason I'm saying this is I feel like one of the things you see with people who are rallying against wokeism is that, you know, when you start a journal like the Journal for Unpopular Ideas, I don't think there's that much homogeneity of views that it's that repressive. There's more room than this overarching consensus. And the Journal of Unpopular Ideas, you know, it's a crank project.
Yeah, I want to echo your point about consensus because it is important to keep in mind that there are very few things about which any discipline has an overwhelming consensus, but there are even fewer things about which multiple disciplines have an overwhelming consensus. And race realism is one of those things.
It's a super consensus.
I mean, it's largely uncontroversial,
right,
to say that race are not biological kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So just still testing the limits of academic freedom, Lee, you use the example of a professor refusing to use the appropriate pronouns. I certainly, and I don't think any of you, would defend on the basis of academic freedom a professor who uses racial slurs in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, what's the difference between a racial slur and race realism? It seems to me that one could make the argument that they, in fact, are the same kind of performative use of language. And if I'm not allowed to teach using racial slurs, I should not be allowed to teach using race realism.
Well, I would defend someone using racial slurs in the classroom if they were reading Huckleberry Finn, for example, not using them to like address.
You're meaning mentioned and not use.
Mentioned.
Yeah.
Mentioned. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I would definitely defend mentioning and not using.
Right.
Just want to be clear on that point.
And clearly, I think we all would agree that a scholar like, for example, former guest Del McWhorter, who's written a lot on a genealogical history of the concept of race, for her to present race realist texts from the 19th century, we don't object to that because she's doing research to sort of show the opposite of that.
Yeah, so assuming that the question that you're asking us is about someone who uses racial slurs.
Yes.
In the classroom. I think that's a really tough question, but we can make a distinction, for example, between the use of certain words or certain language or even certain claims for ideological reasons and those not for ideological reasons. You know, if I just started referring to all my female students as bitches, I'm like, hey, bitch, what do you think? It's not a part of a lesson. Like, I'm not teaching them anything. I'm taking on an already established ideology about the inferiority of women and employing it in the classroom prejudicially as a prejudice against certain students. I think that's different than trying to forward knowledge, even if I'm wrong about it.
I agree wholeheartedly with that position, Lee. But you saying that infuriates me because look at the three of us going out of our way to defend the rights of perhaps someone like Kofnas to make the arguments that they do when his entire scholarly career is set to prevent what he perceives as wokeism and prevent us from teaching egalitarianism.
Egalism.
Well,
or equalism.
Yeah, we're all just equalists. If you were to ask me what this podcast is about, I would say it's about having a drink while having fun talking about serious things. But the drinks we have, and also the server space we use, cost us money. You can help keep this podcast independent and perhaps more importantly ad-free by signing up at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. For less than the cost of a mild night of drinking per month, you'll be helping to defray many costs of our podcast, and you're saving us from having to start our own cult or MMA. If you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, or several of them, gosh, make it a daily donation. Just visit our website at hotelbarpodcast.com, and there you'll find links to support us through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App. As always, we really appreciate your listening, and we really appreciate your helping us to keep pouring wisdom one conversation at a time.
Is it time for the big announcement yet?
Well, before we get there, I think it would be important to talk about something that came up when Jason read the AAUP's definition of academic freedom that we didn't quite touch on. And I think if we don't touch on it, we might be misunderstood in what we've been saying so far. And that is that part of what academic freedom protects is that even the statistics professor who, outside of the classroom, outside of research, outside of the institution, takes a political position, academic freedom protects them in their job so that they can't get fired for holding an unpopular political opinion in a realm of life that has absolutely nothing to do with the university, with the classroom, with research.
Yeah.
You know, we're now still in the midst of the Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip, and a lot of faculty members, I think, who hold positions on either side of this or the multiple sides of this feel like they are unable to voice their positions on these issues for fear that they might lose their job as professor of statistics.
Nobody should be fired for saying free Palestine.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I would say, however, that there are good reasons to fire people who advocate genocide, period.
Yeah.
Most universities, even with robust academic freedom policies, have, what do we call it, moral turpitude clauses, right? Yeah. Like, you know, what greater example of moral turpitude is there? If I'm posting on Facebook that women should be raped or Palestinian children should be murdered or Jews should be wiped off of the face of the earth, mm-hmm. that is a good reason to fire someone. And that doesn't violate academic freedom.
Right. In public institutions or institutions that take government funding, it might violate the constitutionally protected right to free speech, but that's different than academic freedom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We have students. We're part of a community. And I think part of the issue for me is that we have to conduct ourselves in such a way that anyone of any background, et cetera, should feel comfortable and welcome in our classroom. That's our job.
Yeah.
And
so equalist.
It is, though. Part of the thing that's driving some of the race realism thing is this idea that equality is both a metaphysical notion, if you want to use that language. In other words, we talk about equality, we're talking about the fact that, as the Stuart Hall line says, you know, the differences amongst any racial group are as great or greater than the differences between supposed racial groups with any inequality, intelligence, morality, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever.
Right.
So it's in part a fact, but it's also in part a norm. The line from the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, is sort of an ideal as much as a reflection of a supposed reality. The acknowledgement of the fact and also the ideal of the norm.
Right.
Treating people as equals is a good idea.
Yeah. If I could just tag on to that, though, it's also important to note the difference between somebody like Kaufness saying everybody's not equal and somebody like the three of us saying everybody's not equal.
Yes.
Of course, the ideal is that all people are created equal, but all people are not equal.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, that is a fact. That fact, I would say, you would say, Rick would say, is not rooted in genetics. It's not rooted in biology. It's not caused by some natural force. Mm-hmm. It is a socially constructed, repeated, perpetuated imbalance of power. But it is the case that everybody's not equal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as much as Kaufness wants to defend the chimera that is the biological reality of race, he wants to accuse us of defending the non-existent nothingness of what I would call an actual on-the-ground difference in power in social political relations.
And it's also the case that power, like many other social phenomena, does not have a kind of algorithmic operation right. like we see in genetics or biology or physics. And so we can't just transpose the model of the hard sciences onto social realities and expect that we're going to see evidently the truth of those social realities in the way that we normally presume that we do in the hard sciences. Here at the hotel bar, Rick, Jason, and I like to pour philosophy straight into your ears. We're an independent and ad-free podcast, and we'd like to keep it that way. But the only way we can do that is with listener support. You can help us defray some of our production costs by signing up to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotelbarsessions. There are several levels of monthly donations there that you can sign up for, and every one of them helps us keep raising our glasses to deep conversations. If you'd prefer to make a one-time donation, or several one-time donations, just visit our website at hotelbarpodcast.com, where you can find links to support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, or Cash App, and you can keep enjoying our tipsy philosophy and sobering insights. Thank you.
So now is it time for the big announcement?
Kept people holding on for too long. So the big announcement is that this current season is going to be my final season as a regular co-host of Hotel Bar Sessions.
You do not have the academic freedom to say that.
I am stepping away in part to dedicate some time to some projects locally here in Maine that I'll be announcing elsewhere. I'm sad about this. Another thing I say, because we're talking about who's going to fill my seat, is as a lover of the show and a fan of the show before I was a guest of the show.
Not a guest. A host.
I was a guest and then a host. But
yeah,
a host of the show. You know, I also hope that my absence could become a place for voices that we don't hear enough of in philosophy. So I'm not going to say my shoes are difficult to fill, but the task of filling my shoes should also be of maybe changing things up a bit, because I think it would make for a stronger and better show. And I very much want this show to continue on and go back to being longtime listener, as they say.
Jason, I think Lee would agree. We're really going to miss you. And it's been a lot of fun getting together with you every week and talking about these issues. I just want to insist that you and I are completely different kind of Marxists and completely different kind of white meat and completely different kind of cis men. So I don't know what you're referring to there. I mean, obviously I'm kidding. And as much as we'll miss you, I share your hope that we can use this as an opportunity to bring in voices with different experiences and different backgrounds and different philosophical interests. But thank you so much. It's been a real privilege to speak with you every week.
Well, I'm not going to say goodbye to you yet, Jason, for two reasons. One, because you're not leaving. We still have the rest of the season to do. But also because you're not leaving. So for listeners, Jason's staying on the team. He's just stepping back from the mic, very similar to Charles Peterson, previous co-host, who stepped back. He's still on our team. Wow, Rick, we got to stop leaving dead bodies around. As many times as I've talked about having a backyard full of hatchets, right, it looks like there's co-hosts back there too. No, but we're really glad that Jason's going to have a chance to do some of this local activist work that he's been really wanting to do, and we're behind you. However, that does mean that we are currently looking to fill Jason's spot at the microphone, his stool at the bar. So we wanted to say to listeners that for the first time, we're actually putting out an open call for a co-host. There are a few things that we want. You know, I would personally like somebody who's not exactly like me and Rick. You can read the word white there. So people of color are especially encouraged to apply. Also, so far, I've been the only woman on this podcast. I wouldn't mind having another woman. So if you are a person of color or a woman, we will especially look at your application. We do actually want to talk to you. So once we start hearing back from people who are interested, we'll schedule a Zoom session, you know, see how we jive, see how we talk to one another. And yeah, so keep an eye out for an announcement from all of us. We'll put it on all of our social media. If you're a listener, we'd especially love to hear from you.
And if you've been screaming into your headphones for all the time you've been listening, thinking that you had something better to say than we said, well,
here's your chance.
Step up. Put your mouth where the microphone is.
And yeah, I'll say this to anyone considering this. This is a great experience. Rick and Lee are a lot of fun. One of the things I strongly support about the show is that we try as much as possible to do philosophy, as Lee would say, in the vernacular, to see what it looks like when we're not teaching a text or following the scripts of a certain kind of philosophy, and try to put ideas to the test with each other. It's really helpful because, going back to the sub-theme of capitalism ruining everything, much of the voices out there in the world are not really interested in raising the kinds of questions that we're interested in raising. So every place you can get these questions out there, I mean, I do think that philosophy has embraced the classroom to its demise, really, and has treated academia as its only site of production and dissemination. Mm-hmm. That was a huge historical mistake, and we need to, as much as possible, get philosophy in as many places as possible. And that's one of the things that this podcast does and does so well. I've learned a lot about how to try and do that from being here. If you think of yourself as trying to be out in the world as a philosopher, this is a great place to do that. It's both supportive and engaging.
Yeah, calling all public philosophers. Here's your chance. We've already got an audience. We've already got a podcast. So see if we jive together. And yeah, we're looking forward to hearing from all of you guys. But with that said, our bartender is giving us last call. Note to future possible co-hosts, we can't just keep drinking and talking forever. We do get a last call every time. And so we've got to get out of here. I'll catch you guys next time.
All right. Later.
Bye.